welcome everyone to episode number 4 of Talking Shop Down Under. I have with me Paul Batem. Paul, welcome.
Thanks very much, Richard.
It's good to have you. Do you want to give everyone who doesn't know you a bit of an intro of yourself?
Sure. I'm a Canberra-based software developer. I've been working professionally for a bit over 7 years. I work for a Canberra-based ISV called F1 Solutions. We do a majority of work for Australian government, a bit for private business, but mostly government. And we target basically exclusively the Microsoft stack, so SQL Server and .NET, that sort of thing.
Okay, and you do quite a bit of that back-end type work in what you do day-to-day?
Well, are you talking about working with databases and stuff? I work with them only as much as I have to. Generally, I favor using tools that sort of keep me away from the database, I guess you should say.
Okay, so one of those tools, for those people who don't know, is
Fluent in Hibernate.
Dun, dun, dun. There you go, that was our little huzzah moment. So we'll talk to that in a little bit, but probably first, one of the things that developers have to do quite a bit, you know, have a day job, but then a lot of people do open source work as well. You're one of those?
Yeah.
So question is, why do you spend your free time on open source?
Well, I guess, I mean, you know, it'd be nice to say that it was for selfless reasons that I just want to give everything away. But the real reason, and I don't know how true this is for people in general, but I do see it as working on open source, especially if you can pick the right type of projects and stuff, is you can do it for selfish reasons. You can do it for your career. There's obviously a lot more to it than that. I mean, the reason why people generally program at home is that they don't really get that their itch isn't being scratched at their day job for whatever reason. So often it starts simply because there's new technology that they want to play with, or new things that they want to learn about, or they have an idea if they think something that's you know would be useful and fun to do. So they start that way. But I guess for me, although I spend a bit of time, you know, doing programming in that outside of work, I specifically targeted open source because I'd seen that a bunch of sort of high profile people from Microsoft had been sort of hired there out of open source. You know, people who'd been doing open source work, stuff like people like Scott Hanselman, Phil Hack, Rob Connery,
mm-hmm.
And so I guess I looked at these people and I thought, well, Microsoft's attitude's changing a bit. There is a bit of a culture shift happening there, and I wanted to find a way to stand out and improve myself, and trying to do open source and do something that was popular and useful would sort of help get my name out there and eventually improve my career prospects.
So. That project you're doing, Fluent in Hibernate, how did you get involved in that? You didn't kick it off?
No, I'm not a founder for any projects at this point. I mean, with Fluent in Hibernate, it was kind of like a right place at the right time. I'd been using in Hibernate for about a year or so, and I was getting more involved in like the old .NET community and sort of trying to get an idea of what sort of projects were going around. And Fluent in Hibernate, it started as basically like a sort of a spin-off. Like, it was some work that Jeremy Miller had done.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeremy kind of had his own open source projects, Structure Map and Storyteller and that. And he sort of realized that this thing he was building was going to be quite useful and generally useful to lots of in Hibernate users out there. And so he went looking for somebody to sort of hand that off to. And James Gregory, fellow from the UK, took that responsibility. So he took basically the lead for the project. And, you know, as I said, it's sort of right place, right time. I was looking for an open source project to get involved with, and I basically put my hand up for Fluent in Hibernate when I was just getting started.
So you didn't join the project by just submitting patches, and eventually they went, oh, look, these patches aren't too bad, I'll invite you.
Yeah, not quite, no, because it was really right when, I mean, you know, James sort of said, okay, well, I'm going to take this, you know, who's interested in joining me? And there are just a few people put their hands up. And so it was, I didn't really earn my position in the typical way of sort of submitting several patches and eventually getting made a committer. So I guess I had the quick, easy way in this time.
So one of the interesting things, a lot of open source projects are very much single person projects, I suppose, more than anything else. How do you find it dealing with other people on a project and coordinating effort?
It's interesting. I guess like it can be a bit difficult, especially when you consider the fact that with something like an open source project that's being done in everybody's free time, you know, you don't know how much time people are going to have to spend. You don't know how much time you're going to spend on the project over the next week. So that can be a bit difficult. The other thing is that because people are doing it for the sort of their own reasons, it's not like a software project where you're doing it work where the goal is to deliver something to a customer so that you can get paid, and you're going to have conflicts of interest, well, not conflicts of interest, but conflicting interests. You're going to have some people wanting different things. For me, certainly, I find that part of why I sort of do the open source is that I am going to get to scratch that itch a little bit more, spend a bit more time refactoring things or trying to find an elegant solution to things then sometimes I feel will be justified in my day job. But then you'll have you might have other people on the project who are really, you know, just looking to get a job done, to get something up and working as quickly as possible. So you can get a bit of tension there, but you know, you work it out. You give authority to one person and let them make the ultimate decisions, and then it shakes out, I think.
Now, how do you coordinate efforts in terms of source control and tracking things to be done and who's done what and sharing and building, etc.?
So I mean, the project was originally hosted in Google Code. We used Subversion and we migrated to GitHub. I guess that was about a year ago or something like that.
The reasons for that?
Well, I mean, I don't want to talk about Git all of this podcast, but I mean, I guess the thing is with distributed version control, you really have to try it out and actually get a feel for what it's about. It's something that I read a little bit about, but until I actually sat down and started using something like Git or other popular option is Mercurial. It really wasn't until I sat down and started using it that I saw the advantages, specifically the ability to have a local copy of the entire repository and to do all your commits locally, view history locally, create local branches. It just lets you do whatever the hell you want without getting in anybody's way. And I really like the ability to do lots of fine-grained commits rather than doing massive commits that represent an entire piece of functionality. You get that flexibility when you use a distributed version control system. What we actually did was Subversion, there's an integration with Subversion and Git. The tool's called Git SVN. Mm-hmm. And so I used that for a while we're still on Subversion to basically learn Git. And some sort of other contributors did a similar thing, and eventually there was enough of us felt comfortable. I think James was already comfortable. I think he'd been using it for ages to sort of make the move. And the real other advantage for an open source project, beyond the sort of like the beauty of having a local repository as being somebody who works regularly on the project, is the idea of with something with like GitHub, the ability to have people fork your project, make changes, and send you a pull request. The workflow for that is really simple, really straightforward. It works beautifully. I much prefer it to receiving patch files and that. So it really, Git and GitHub are a wonderful combination. I really enjoy working with them both.
So just for those who live in the whole hub and spoke type environment, you know, with that central Subversion or TFS type repository, what exactly happens when you do these pushes of changes and merges across different forks of the project?
Well, I mean, I guess what actually happens is even though it's a decentralized system, you will decide on an official repository.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, it's James's. And so the way it works is I kind of act as it's sort of like a lieutenant. There is I think the Linux kernel has this sort of model where there are sort of like several lieutenants that work under Linus. The idea is that they know bits of the system or they accept patches and they do work in their repositories and then they make them available to Linus, on the main person running the project, so that you end up sort of distributing the work and doing it in such a way that you kind of have like a sort of a network of trust. It could be multi-level. But in the end, like you really do need, it's so convenient to have an official repository that I don't know any projects that don't have one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of a matter of, I mean, for us, the way it works is that I make changes on my repository and I just send them to James regularly and he pulls them in. They become part of basic what is the official trunk. And I mean, you mentioned like you mentioned earlier talking about TFS and Subversion a little bit. I guess like it is an interesting question. What happens in a more sort of corporate environment? Whether or not you would use the same workflow or whether or not you would do something differently. And I don't have any experience with that area. I do think that you would expect it to shake out a bit differently, because with open source projects, typically you do have responsibility in sort of like you have committers and then non-committers.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, in a corporate setting, you're not really gonna have that. So I think maybe it would work a bit differently. I would love to use Git at work, but yeah.
It just hasn't come up yet.
Well, the thing is, I mean, there's a lot of value in TFS if you have, like, if you're using it for everything, lots of integration and that. And it's very difficult to make a compelling argument. Even if you want to rip out one bit, there's a lot of integration that you lose. So I can't make the argument for saying, let's stop using the version control element and use something like Git. It's just Well, yeah, it's hard to sell.
From a TFS perspective, I think it'll be quite interesting to see what happens in the next version, because I know that people on the team have posted on their blogs about doing a distributed version control for TFS. What shape it would take, I don't know.
That would be great. Like, I mean, I saw you mention that on Twitter, I think. And I definitely think that they need something to address this need. Once you've felt, you know, distributed source control, you really don't want to go back to the centralized model.
So from a check-in, a local check-in perspective, what sort of things do you check in? You don't do a check-in every time you add a unit test or anything, do you?
Locally?
Yeah.
Sometimes. Depends on what type of thing I'm doing and I guess how disciplined I'm feeling. Like, you can... It's so fast to basically check in stuff with Git that you can be at a point where I wouldn't say it's one per unit test, but I mean, typically, like, a lot of what I do is accepting patches, and I guess what will happen is I will take that patch and then I'll have a couple of cleanup steps.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll usually happen as a couple of cleanup steps will happen as sort of local commits. And then if I feel like it, sometimes I can sort of rewrite those and combine them and try to make it into a history that makes a bit more sense or is a bit easier to follow. But often I don't bother. I don't really feel like I haven't been at the point yet where having too many commits has felt like has been a problem.
Okay, and do you do one of the Git features is the ability to take multiple commits and roll them up into one? Do you do that before pushing?
Yeah, occasionally, if something's come out ugly, and I guess I kind of want to make it look nice,
hide your embarrassing code
because I really like that ability to sort of rewrite history with Git. But it's something I found like I got infatuated with it at first, but I've sort of moved on a bit from that. And I don't find myself doing it as much as I used to.
Okay, what about local branching? That's one of the things people talk about with Git as being a big plus. Do you do a lot of local branching?
Yeah. I find that I run, it's just so easy to – I use – like I know with Git a lot of people will tell you, oh, you should just use the command line. And if you're somebody who's worked in the command line for a long time, maybe you're comfortable with that. But for me, I don't need Visual Studio integration and that, but I do use some of the GUI tools. Git GUI and Git K come with msysgit, and they're both really, really useful. And especially with Git GUI, with Git K, it's really easy to basically you get a tree visualization, and you can just right click on places and say, I want to make this a branch from this point, and that. And I find it just often it's really easy. I'm doing several things at once. I've got patches coming in and bugs being fixed, and I get somewhere between each of them. I don't necessarily finish one and then move to the next. And using the local branches makes that really easy to manage.
But one of the issues is branching's never been a problem with, you know, Subversion or tools like that. Branching's simple. You know, you can create a branch, no drama. It's the merge back that becomes a real pain in the butt.
Yeah, Git's merge is awesome. It's just really smart. Most of the time you don't get conflicts. When you do get conflicts, you just got to make sure you set it up so that you get some sort of diff tool that you're comfortable with. I use pforMerge. There's plenty of others. You just got to make sure that's hooked up so that when Git does get the conflicts, you tell it to run the merge tool and you just run through them. And I've found that I have to spend very little time with merges, very little at all. Most of the time, it just works.
Cool. So what are some of the other issues with Affluent and Hibernate that you've run across in terms of development? What are the things that have been problem areas more than anything else, I suppose?
Well, I guess, do you think I should I give a bit of background on what Fluent and Hibernate's about? Because we haven't
That's
actually...
That's probably not a bad idea.
Fluent and Hibernate it's an alternative to using XML to configuring in Hibernate. In Hibernate, we'll take XML in a format called HBM, we typically call it. The problem with XML is, it's not strongly typed and it's not really refactor friendly, and...
It's verbose. It's hard to read. It's easy to make mistakes.
There's lots of things to not like about XML. So Fluent and Hibernate is a library that will makes heavy use of lambda expressions. You basically use it to tell it what classes you want, what properties you want mapped, how you want to map inheritance, how you want to do. Lets you describe conventions to say, I always have my ID column with the suffix of underscore ID, or that sort of thing. So it lets you just basically use code to do your mapping rather than XML. You rely on IntelliSense a huge amount, and it basically gives you a much more convenient way of configuring in Hibernate. I mean, there are some downsides. It's not complete. There are you'll always get posts on the mailing list saying I've got this cool feature in Hibernate that I found, I want to use it, how do I use it? And often we don't have a good answer other than you're going to have to use XML for that mapping.
And please submit a patch.
And please submit a patch. So sometimes I wonder why I do that as my patch queue gets really big. the beauty of Fluent and Hibernate is, the refactoring support that you'll get once it's just looking at your classes and your members and that, you're free to refactor without having to worry about doing anything else at all. And all the convention stuff, it's also got a component in there that called auto mapping, where you don't even need to tell it what classes or what properties to map. It'll just do reflection and find stuff and do its best guess.
So that's different from AutoMapper, the other project though, right?
Yeah, good point. It's unfortunate confusion or just a unclear sort of terminology. There's Jimmy Boggard's AutoMapper. That's a different thing. There is a component within Fluent and Hibernate that does reflection and generates mappings for you, and we call that AutoMapping. Anyway, the AutoMapping, if you've got like a new development, so you don't have a really funky database, mm-hmm. that's got a really bad schema, like if you're kind of defining your own schema, the auto mapping means that you get to the point where you barely have to do anything at all to get up and running with just basically classes with relationships and inheritance and that sort of stuff, and that
So it makes assumptions around column names, mapping property names in objects, et cetera, and things like that.
Yeah. And then all you do is you at some point you do a pass where you go, okay, I want to spend a bit of time actually looking at my schema, what it's generating, and clean that up. And then you go through and write a bunch of conventions that say, for this type of foreign key, use this convention for the name. Just lots of rules that let you determine what SQL types you want to be using for certain types of whether you don't want text fields or string or varchars or whatever. Just lots of rules that let you control that stuff. And so you sort of try to do it all in just a general rule rather than per specific case, per individual class.
Mm-hmm. So from an architectural point of view, if you're putting a solution together with Fluent and Hibernate, are there any particular patterns to follow or anything you really need to be aware of?
Well, I guess there are, I don't know, like one thing is that some people, I don't know if this is architecture, but some people generally don't like to put public members when they don't have to and stuff. And because Fluent and Hibernate say it's using Lambda expressions and stuff, so you kind of the members that you're mapping have to be public in that. So sometimes people can't get the real benefits out of Fluent and Hibernate because they're a little bit more picky about how they expose members on mm-hmm. their classes. From a high level in terms of architecture in that, Fluent and Hibernate, it sort of sits on top of Hibernate. So you can already go and find the articles and stuff that give you sort of best practices or examples of how to set up in Hibernate. Like if you've got a web application, how to handle session per request and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you can pretty much just sort of sit Fluent and Hibernate on top of that. One nice thing is Sharp Architecture. Sharp Architecture's a project that integrates ASP.NET MVC with Fluent and Hibernate and a bunch of other stuff. You can actually rip out a whole bunch of the useful session per request and that sort of stuff straight out of Sharp Architecture. And I've actually got a project that's not a web-based system, but it's using a bunch of code from Sharp Architecture anyway, just because it's more convenient than writing it yourself. So it can be a pretty useful resource for some of that scaffolding or general gunk that you need when you get it set up.
Okay.
You also asked me about some of the issues with Fluent and Hibernate itself, and I decided to seek into explaining what it was about. Should we go back to that?
I was about to ask, but go right. For it. Go.
I guess with Fluent and Hibernate, it started off as a pretty simple code base that would have there's a Fluent interface, and the methods on that Fluent interface would just generate. Was store XML behind the scenes, and then you'd pretty much say go, I'm done, and it would spit out a bunch of XML to files. The problem with this was that there was pretty much no separation between the Fluent interface that's got all these. The Fluent interface has got all these methods that return an object back, so you mm-hmm. can call the next method, and there ends up being lots of sort of gunk that you have to keep track of or hold on to. To make the Fluent interface work, kind of wanted that separated from the whole process of generating the XML. So in I think in late 2008, I sort of started. I had some time off, and I started sort of working on a rewrite to try to get an idea of what I would like it to look like. And that sort of went well until the point where we couldn't figure out exactly what to do. We had an existing code base, and then we had this rewrite that was missing like lots of the functionality. And it's the classic classic sort of problem that you have where you every time you try to do a rewrite of a system, you end up having to maintain the old system at the same time.
Yep.
When are you going to switch over and all that sort of stuff. And what ended up happening was with James took my code base and basically merged it in. Or shoved it in to the existing code base in such a way that there were a few things that I was trying to achieve with a rewrite that weren't really necessary. I was trying to output HBM classes rather than XML. Mm-hmm. This would be classes that you could feed directly to in Hibernate, so you wouldn't have to do the parse and validation.
So it'd be a little bit faster on startup.
Yeah, but there were problems with that. specifically around dealing with different versions of InHibernate. You really don't want Fluent and InHibernate to break as soon as you recompile it against a new version of InHibernate.
Okay.
So what James did was basically he ripped out the features that were going to cause us too much problems and left the one thing, which was the separation between XML generation and the Fluent interface. And that's once that was in the main code base, we had an opportunity to do things like the conventions. I mean, there are sort of basic conventions in Fluent and Hibernate where you can just tell it, I want my keys to look like this. But there's another API that allows you to say, for this particular type of mapping, define some code that checks some rules. So some people like to put attributes
mm-hmm.
on their classes for extra information that determines how it gets mapped, sort of just their own custom ones. And these conventions allow people to sort of write code that checks for certain conditions and then applies certain changes. And those conventions wouldn't have really been possible without a separation between the Fluent interface and the mapping model that you serialize to XML. And so really the one thing that was important from that rewrite got kept. Something that allows us to, it uses the visitor pattern.
Yep.
And I would love to move it to C# 4 and do as Joe Albahari in last episode mentioned, you can use dynamic to ditch visitor. And I would love to do that because there's a bunch of visitor junk in Fluent and Hibernate to make that stuff work. And I would like to, it took me a while to get right and it's a bit confusing and I would love to get rid of it. But maybe one day. It's not really crucial right now.
And just force everyone to move to .NET 4, it'd be fine.
Yeah, well,
maybe not.
Yeah, I think it'll be a while away.
All right, mate, that's probably about all we've got time for. Now, if people want to get involved in the project.
Oh, yes, well, Forkus. And send me a pull request.
Sorry, what did you say? This is a family show.
there's a wiki for Fluent and Hibernate, and there's a contributing page on there. It's got some information for first-time contributors. There's always a bit of a catch with Git around the line endings. There's mm-hmm. some settings that you have to get right. That's why that page exists mostly. It's just so people have something to read about that.
Okay, if you send me the link, I'll put it in the show notes.
No worries. But really, it is as simple as going onto GitHub, making sure you've got an account, clicking the fork button from James's repository because you want to fork the official one, making changes with Git, pushing them to your repository, and then sending me a pull request.
All right,
and I love getting changes that way.
If I'm someone who doesn't have Git, what tools do I need?
Well, you're going to need to install msysgit. That's assuming that you're running on Windows, that is, which I generally assume.
I think that's a fair assumption.
And, you know, to work on Fluent and Hibernate, you're going to need Visual Studio, I guess, unless you could use something else.
Yeah, Notepad, man, and do command line.
If you just want to edit the files, yeah, I suppose.
Real men do it.
Otherwise, there's not much else that comes to mind. Like, I mean, it's designed such that you pull the code down and it just builds. Oh, yeah, you need Ruby if you want to use the command line build, but you don't have to do that.
Sorry, what are you using for the build?
We use Rake for Fluent and Hibernate's build. Rake is a build library for Ruby. So if you want to build Fluent and Hibernate from the command line, you have to install Ruby, and then there's a batch file that you run that installs the necessary gems like Rake and some of the Rake's dependencies.
Okay.
But it's not really necessary for somebody who's contributing. You can, the build still works within Visual Studio and it's fully functional. It's just that using Rake, it does some nice stuff involving running the unit tests and a few other things. And James is a big Ruby fan. James hates XML. So
I can understand that.
Avoid anything like
that. So there's actually a project on GitHub called nrake as well.
Yeah, I haven't looked at that one. Is that one running on? It's not something that's going to run on Iron Ruby. That's actually
a fork. Runs on the normal Ruby at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. I haven't looked at that one at all.
I'm just giving James Crisp a little plug because that's his.
Cool. I might take a look.
Yep. All right. That probably wraps us up. It's about half an hour. So thanks for your time, mate. It's excellent.
Yeah, no worries. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks again, mate. And thank you, everyone, for listening to Talking Shop. Down under.